back and I'm still an alcoholic, and we'll go back to this journey through the steps, and we left off, we're going to talk about the common manifestations of self, and I mentioned Fellowship Hall has 27 character defects on their wall, and Serenity has 28 on their wall. And I went to a retreat a few years ago, and Father Roger, who was the retreat master, he had a list of character defects that were in excess of the 28 that Serenity has. He had 22 in addition to that, so I've got a list of 50. And I'm told that on the internet, someplace, that they have a list of 100 character defects. And of course, in the 12 and 12, they suggest inventorying the seven deadly sins. So, let's see. Common manifestations of self are three in number. 12 and 12 has seven deadly sins. Three is less than seven. Seven is more than twice three. And then, of course, we have the 27 from Fellowship Hall, the 28 from Serenity, the 50 that I have, and the 100 that are on the internet. So you're free to select whatever you want. But for me, I like the sound of three. Okay. So, what's the number one offender? Resentment is the number one offender. It says so right here in the book. In dealing with resentments, we set them on paper. Now, I don't know about you, but when I was early in Alcoholics Anonymous, I went to a number of meetings where they talked about the four-step inventory, and they were talking about the mental four-step inventory. Don't you like the sound of that? That appealed to me. And I went back, when Bob and Ken and I met the following Friday, we met every Friday, I told them about that mental four-step inventory that they're doing down there at that meeting. And Bob said, let's get out the book. And he read this part. In dealing with resentments, we set them on paper. Well, okay, you need paper. Tom, come on up here and get some paper for these fine folks. Al, could you help us out here, please? I know you're relaxing and all that, but just give, you can take that side of the room, and Al, you can take this side of the room, and you can give one to everybody, and don't get a resentment over it, but now what I'm having Tom and Al give you is a sheet of paper that says review of resentments, and if you compare the language on this paper with the language in your big book, I think you'll find nothing inconsistent between the two. The only suggestion I would make to you is that in our big book there is a sample format which appears on page 65. And our inclination, because of our training, is that we read from left to right. But the instructions in the book don't say do this from left to right. The instructions in the book says we list it. And you look like a pretty intelligent group, so my guess is you know how to make a list, like a grocery list, or a Christmas list, or any kind of list. You make it from top to bottom. You make a list. Now, maybe you've tried to make this list from left to right, and you probably got really angry. Because you did, I'm resentful at my father. I start in on the causes. Next thing you know, I am really mad, and I ball the thing up and I throw it away. Because I can't do this that way. And I think that's why the instructions are clear. We list people, institutions, principles with whom we were angry. Institutions, you mean like the Department of Parole and Probation, the Circuit Court, the IRS, list them. Well, okay. And then we do the affects my. Well, we do the list, and then we do the cause. And when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I could always tell you who I was angry at, and I could tell you instantaneously why I was angry at them. I could tell you exactly what they did to me. But I had no idea what part of self was affected. None whatsoever. And so this was indeed an uncovering and discovering process for me, as I think it is for most people. This is the opportunity for the first time in my life to really get to take a look at the powers in my life which have been driving me even without my understanding. Now, these resentments things, the book says, to the precise extent that we permit these, do we squander the hours that might have been worthwhile? Well, the Audubon United Methodist Church in Hagerstown 15 years ago, the pastor put out on the board, every minute I spend in anger, I deprive myself of 60 seconds of happiness. That's our stuff. He stole it from us. Because it says here, for every hour that I squander the hours that might have been worthwhile. Every 60 minutes I squander an hour when I could have lived happily for that hour if I learned how to live free of resentment. Now, I give credit to the National Football League. You ladies, you may have some experience with this, but I know you guys do. And I don't know who your team is. I'm going to say my team's the Baltimore Ravens. And I don't know who we're playing this week. I think last week we played the Bengals. I was traveling, so I didn't get to see the game. But invariably, in one of those NFL games, in the first half, there's some close play. The issue is whether or not the receiver got his foot down or not. And they replay it. They fire up that NFL CBS instant resentment replay machine, and they show the referee blew the call. And because the referee blew the call, the Ravens had to punt, and the Bengals scored. And the ref... It's always one. But two. So, we go to halftime. And back in the studio, they're talking about the first half. And they're talking about the pivotal turning point in the half. Let's fire up that CBS NFL instant resentment replay machine and take a look at that reception one more time. And just like when they played that thing back in the first quarter, the ref blew the call. It cost the Ravens. And the Bengals scored. Could we play that in slow motion? Let's take that instant resentment replay machine and play it in slow motion. Now, I'm watching this, and I'm getting upset. Because every time they replay it, I get more upset. End of the game, Bengals win. Ravens lose. All because of that blown call in the first quarter. And what do they do at the end of the game when they go back to the studio and they're reviewing scores of all the games? Well, let's take a look at that pivotal call in the first quarter of that Ravens game. Fire up that instant resentment replay machine. And they play it again. And they play it in slow motion. I am really upset. That night on SportsCenter, when they're doing the top 10 plays of the weekend, let's take a look at that reception in the first quarter of the Ravens-Bengal game, and they fire up that instant resentment replay machine one more time, and I get upset again. And it's not good to get upset before you go to bed. In the morning, when I wake up, I turn on ESPN, and there they are. They're replaying that blown call from the first quarter of the Bengals-Ravens game, and now I am upset not only on Sunday, I am upset on Monday. And you can see where this is going, can't you? The NFL has conspired against me and are making me very resentful, and it's their fault. And I think each of us, in our own way, have our own instant resentment replay machine, which we can conjure up at any time, day or night, by just reflecting upon him or her or what they did to us. And we relive that moment. And these resentments have the power to kill. And we're going to have to learn how to live free of anger. I didn't know that you could do that. Well, how do you do that? Well, they tell us how to do it right here in this book. It says that when I find myself getting upset at him or her, I need only reflect for a moment that they are spiritually ill people. Not necessarily alcoholic. There are a lot of spiritually ill people loose in the world. And some of them look fairly normal. And the reason I know this is because I saw Ruth Graham on Larry King about 10 years ago, maybe 15 years ago, being interviewed by Larry King. And of course, Ruth Graham is married to Billy Graham. And Larry asked one of his intellectually penetrating questions about whether or not Mrs. Graham would get upset with the Reverend Graham when he traveled around the world speaking to stadiums full of people, leaving her home with the children. Did you ever think about divorcing him, Mrs. Graham? And she said, "No, Larry, divorce never came up. But homicide did." And I thought, of all the people that I knew or knew of, I would say that the Reverend Graham's wife was probably a pretty spiritual person. But if she's thinking about choking the life out of the Reverend Billy Graham, she might have a degree, a small degree nonetheless, but a degree of spiritual illness. Because I am not aware that choking the life out of anybody is considered to be a spiritual act. And so it says in our book that anybody that I come in contact with that gets me stirred up is a spiritually ill person. And I am to ask God to show me how to show them the same tolerance, pity, and patience that I would gladly grant to a sick friend. You hear that? We asked God. Fourth step prayer, part A. They hid it in here. Third step prayer, easy to find. Got big quotations around it. This doesn't have any quotations. It just says, we ask God. Anytime it says anything like, we ask God, that's a prayer. So you might want to be looking for that. And we avoid retaliation. We avoid argument. What about my justifiable anger? Let me tell you something, folks. You're looking at a person who has never in his entire life ever been angry at another human being. That they didn't provoke me. I am not the kind of guy who goes around getting angry for no reason. My anger is always justified. It is always righteous. And our book says it's the dubious luxury of normal people that for me is poison. Oh, well, let me have a drink of poison. And watch the other guy die. Ain't happening. I'm doing it to myself. I'm creating my own misery. Well, this is a situation that I've got to address because it kills more alcoholics than anything else. What's second most common manifestation of self? Tom, Al, are you ready? Go. You're not moving, Al. Come here. Fear is the second most common manifestation of self, a corrosive thread that goes through the fabric of all of our lives. The big book is very helpful in this regard. because they ask us a very simple question. We ask ourselves why we had them. Well, you're going to hear that, you know, I'm not afraid of much of anything. I do have a little fear of the unknown, fear of failure, fear of success, fear of commitment, fear of being found out. I have a fear of relationships. I have a fear of dying alone. I have a fear of the opinion of others. If you want to do something interesting when you go back to your home group next week, just slip up behind anybody and whisper in their ear, "They know." And walk away. Well, it says, why do we have these fears? And the answer is self-reliance. Self-reliance. This is not nuclear physics and Chinese or rocket science. I have worshipped at the altar of self-sufficiency my entire life before Alcoholics Anonymous. I have made a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God as I understand them, and I don't understand them all that well. But I'm going to be learning because I'm doing this uncovering and discovering, because I'm going to get to then do the discarding. And I think you'll find that the material that's contained on this sheet is pretty consistent with the language that's contained in the big book. The third most common manifestation of self, Al, is what? What? Sex. That's it. I bet you get a big turnout at your home group when you're doing a step meeting on sex, right? For the newcomers, they come looking for a film strip or maybe slide projections or something. I don't know. But there's one thing I do know, that the third most common manifestation of self is sex, and it says in the big book that we put them on paper. So, Vanna, thank you. Vanna number two, thank you. It says we all have sex problems. Now, this sheet may be too much for some of you. Some of you may have to take it down to Kinko's and run off another 50 copies. I don't know. Some of you might just need a 3x5 card. And it's no commentary on anybody or anything. It's your inventory. It's not my inventory. And you got to provide your own pencil, because I don't have any writing instruments to give. But it says we got this down on paper, and that's why I'm giving you paper. This is not a mental four-step inventory. The reality of my behavior, the reality of my conduct, the reality of my relationships with other people becomes real when I get it down on paper. And I've never had an intimate relationship with another human being in which I didn't lie to them, in which I was not inconsiderate of them. I've never had a relationship with another human being wherein I did not arouse jealousy or suspicion or bitterness. Thank you. We get this down on paper, and we ask God to mold our ideals and help us to live up to them. Fourth step, Part C, prayer. I skipped over the fourth step, Part B, prayer. I think you can find it on your own. If you can't, see me tomorrow. We'll talk about it. But it's in there. And then, of course, we turn over to the chapter End of Thinking. One of my most favorite chapters in the book. I've always been very fond of thinking. Think. Haven't gotten anywhere, but I have been doing a lot of thinking. And we open the book to the chapter end of thinking, and lo and behold, they've changed the title, and it's End of Action. End of Action. And now we're going to have to do a fifth step. And why do we have to do a fifth step? They're going to give us the best reason first. If I don't do this step, I'm going to drink. They don't give me the second reason. Because if I drink, I might as well just bend over and grab my ankles and kiss my ass goodbye. Because I'm doomed. I'm doomed. I have no chance. None whatsoever. And that's the way it is for alcoholics. And they tell us about a couple of guys who were not honest with their sponsors and held something back, and they put in real squiggly writing, which I understand is italics, which means pay attention, Jack. They only thought they'd lost their egotism and fear. They only thought that they had humbled themselves. They had to tell someone all their life story. My ego is such, and I think our literature confirms, that fear and pride will conspire together to keep me from doing this. Pride will say, Jack, your case is different. You don't have to do this. And fear will say, Jack, you do not dare do this. And it will leave me frozen in place, and I will die an alcoholic death, either by a slow suicide, drinking, fast suicide, bridge abutment. Because that's the way it is for alcoholics. Unless I have a vital spiritual experience. And this fifth step is most important to a vital spiritual experience. In the book it says that it's okay to delay until you can find a close-mouthed, understanding friend. Keep in mind, this was 1939. If you were in New York or Akron or Cleveland, you might be able to find somebody who was in AA. If you were in Albuquerque or Portland, Oregon or Portland, Maine, the likelihood is it might be more difficult. So the book says it's okay to postpone it. You can ignore that section of the book. There are going to be a lot of people here this weekend who are eminently qualified to do a fifth step with you. If you haven't done a fifth step, then get with one of these folks and do a fifth step. Because if I fail to do a fifth step, I am out of luck. And having done a fifth step, it says I can go back home and I can take the book down off the shelf, and I know people who have put the book up on the shelf so they could take it down off the shelf so that they could say they followed the directions. Sometimes people just took the book out from underneath a chair. But the fact remains, we are encouraged to take out the book and to sit quietly for an hour. And I think there are people in this room who have taken that 1 hour of rest and stretched it into 6 months or a year. Because that's the way we are. We give new meaning to plain English. We don't understand what 1 hour means. We're confused by it. And I certainly don't want to ask my sponsor, what do they mean by an hour? But if I've been painstaking, then I need to ask myself, would I like to learn to live free of selfishness? Would I like to be less self-centered? Yeah. Well, Jack, would you like to be a man of integrity? Would you like to learn how to live an honest life and not lie? I would, indeed. Well, would you like to learn how to live free of anger and to shut down that instant resentment replay machine? Yes, I would. Jack, would you like to learn how to be free of fear? Not necessarily without fear, but to just be released from fear. I would indeed. Jack, would you like to become a considerate person? Would you like to be different than you are now? Yes, I would. Well, good for you, Jack. You are now at step 7. I am fascinated by people who say, I'm working on step six. Really? What are you doing? I'm working on it. What are you doing? Well, I'm writing it out. Really? I think the book says if we can answer to our satisfaction, we look at step six. We have emphasized willingness as being indispensable. Are we now ready to let God remove from us all those things which we admitted were objectionable? That's the selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, fear, and inconsiderate behavior. If we want to hang on to something, we pray for willingness. If we can answer yes, I'd like to be rid of them, we're at step seven. When ready, we say something like this, and they give us the seven-step prayer. I'm sure you've noted that the seven-step prayer contains an amen. You've probably also noticed that the third-step prayer contains no amen. That would seem to indicate that the third step and the seventh step are supposed to be done fairly quickly and close to each other so that we can put step three with step seven and have a completed prayer. The longer I delay that, the more at risk I am. Having done the seventh-step prayer, and since this is a one-day-at-a-time deal, if I don't die tonight, then I am encouraged tomorrow to pray the third and seventh-step prayer as I did this morning upon awakening. I'm encouraged then to make an eighth-step list and then to start those ninth-step amends so I can live in 10, 11, and 12 and equip myself to be of maximum service to God and to my fellow man. I didn't sign up for that. It says God could and would if he were sought. I didn't come here to be a seeker of God. But it turns out I am a seeker of God. In our literature in the fourth chapter, it says that I am to consider myself one of God's intelligent agents. Jack, God's intelligent agent. Al, agent of God. Tom, spearhead of God's ever-advancing intelligence. Yes, God has a sense of humor. God can use all manner of vessels. And we need only look around our rooms to know that that's true. God can use us in a mighty way if we make ourselves available. My ego is such, I say in response to being an agent of God that I don't want to go to China. I don't want to be a missionary to China. I don't want to be selling Watchtower magazines down in the square. That's what my ego tells me. See, I think I have to clean myself up to become worthy of God and then present myself to God. And it turns out that all God wants me to do is present myself. When my mom, when I was a little child and would fall and scrape my knee and go run into my mom and cry, my mom would wash my knee and she'd put Mercurochrome on it and she'd put a bandage on it. I thought that she'd healed my knee. And I now know that she didn't. I now know that what she did was she had provided an environment in which healing could take place. And that's what Alcoholics Anonymous does. It provides an environment in which healing can take place, and I come here broken. And I present myself. And I take action on these steps. And the experience of doing that changes me. And I cannot think my way into right living, but I can live my way into right thinking. By taking the action that I don't think is going to work, I can get a result that I've never had. And I can only do that if I do something that I don't want to do. This program is designed for ego deflation at depth. Each one of these steps is designed to make me do something, to get me to do something that I don't want to do or I don't think is going to work. And then it proves me wrong yet again. And so I'm offered this opportunity to live a second life in the same lifetime. We all have to experience whatever it is that we have to experience in order to get here. It takes what it takes. I sponsor a couple of guys who are 10 and 11 years sober. They were 17 when they got here. There's no way I would have come here when I was 17. I was just getting started. Life was just way too much fun. But they had experienced enough and were pitifully and incomprehensibly demoralized that they were willing to suit up and show up and do the deal. And so they're 28, 29 years old, and they have incredible lives. I have an incredible life. Tom and I were talking coming over from the airport. Who knew that it could be this easy? Who knew that life could be this easy? Living by the principles of the Program of Recovery of Alcoholics Anonymous. I certainly didn't know it. I had to be taught. That meant I had to learn. And it's really difficult to teach something to somebody who already knows it all. It really is. I mean, I'm a knucklehead. I am educated way beyond my ability to understand. And so my case is different. I've told you that. And the only thing about my case that is different is that it took me longer than it took others. That's all. It takes what it takes. But we get ourselves here and we find out that our purpose for living, my purpose, is to fit myself to be of maximum service to God and to the people about me. It's not the God of the church that I grew up in. It's not the God of the church you grew up in. If you're unchurched, it doesn't matter. Because we're here to talk about G.O.D. Good Orderly Direction. Gift of Desperation. Group of Drunks. All of those work for G.O.D. I had to put aside the ideas that I brought with me. Many of them were learned in that church in which I was raised. Others, I don't know where I got them, but I gathered them up as I went along the way. Old ideas that didn't work. And I had to be willing to open myself to the possibility of this program. And as a result, and it says in our literature, that if I do these things, then I'm going to have a wonderful, wonderful life. The great events are going to come to pass for you and countless others. I had no idea that great events could come to pass for me and countless others. I had no idea that I could be part of such great events. In the time that I've been active in the Program of Recovery of Alcoholics Anonymous and have been sponsored people, it's been my privilege to be best man at the weddings of three guys that I sponsor. It was an incredible experience on each one of those occasions, each one different from the other. But to be asked to stand next to somebody whose life has been lifted up out of the ashes, who's been given this opportunity to live a second life in the same lifetime, and to stand there with them. What a tremendous privilege that is. What an honor that is. What a gift that is. You know, if I made out a list of things that I'd like to have as a result of my activity in the Program of Recovery of Alcoholics Anonymous, I say to you what I've heard so many people say, I would have sold myself short. I had no idea the magnitude of what this 12-step program could do for me and to me. And I had to experience it. Now, it's been indicated by Al that he wanted me to spend some time talking about the traditions. And I think the traditions are as equally important to me as the steps are. When I first got here, I used to try to figure out if I was going to a meeting where they were going to have a tradition meeting, because if I was, I'd leave. Because the traditions don't have anything to do with me. But I find out that the traditions have everything to do with me. They certainly are the very thing that holds our groups together. But more importantly, the traditions have a tremendous role to play in my life. Our common welfare should come first. Personal recovery depends upon AA unity. My relationship with my wife is dependent upon our personal relationship and our unity. We have been joined together to be a one flesh couple. I did not know how to do that. I thought it was a 50-50 deal. I thought, you know, if she doesn't meet me halfway, then to hell with it. Well, I was wrong. I didn't know that. It's a 100% deal. I got to give 100%. And then 10% more if necessary. because her common welfare and my common welfare, which are intertwined, are dependent upon our unity. For our purpose, our family purpose, there's only one ultimate authority, Jack. That's a delusional thought, by the way. And it says in our book, we're driven by 100 forms of self-delusion, 100 forms of self-seeking, 100 forms of self-pity, 100 forms of fear. That's 400 forms. And I'm not drinking. That's what happens to me when I'm not drinking. So it's little wonder that I think that I am the know-all and end-all of our family. The ultimate authority is, of course, a loving God who expresses himself in our group conscious, that is, my wife's and mine. We are servants to one another. I didn't know that. I don't rule over her. She doesn't rule over me. We are attempting to be a one flesh couple. And that takes effort and that takes work. But the power of God goes deep. Our literature says that. My experience confirms that. It says in our book, or in our traditions, that the only requirement for membership here in Alcoholics Anonymous is a desire to stop drinking. I don't know about you. Maybe it was the judge who had a desire that you would stop drinking. Maybe it was your husband that had a desire that you would stop drinking. Maybe it was your wife that had a desire that you would stop drinking. Maybe you didn't have a desire to stop drinking. Doesn't make any difference. It's just, let's get in the door. My experience is that nobody gets here by mistake. I would rather be in here by mistake than out there by mistake. Because in here people get to live. And out there, we die. So my wife and I don't drink. I don't have any argument with drinking. We just don't drink. She is of the opinion that she doesn't have to drink. And I don't know how to live not drinking. So if she's drinking, I might get thirsty. So she doesn't drink, and I don't get thirsty. And things seem to work out really well for that. You know, each group should be autonomous, except in matters affecting other groups or AA as a whole. Our family is independent. We're independent of our friends' families. We're independent of our children's families. We love our children. Our children, when they want advice, they call for advice. We give them advice. Frequently, they don't take the advice. It's kind of like when I call my sponsor and I ask him for advice. He gives me advice and I don't take the advice. And I suffer the consequences of that. And he gives me advice and I follow the advice and I get the consequences of that. And I found out that I don't call our children on a daily basis, but I love them. And when they call upon me, I give them advice. And then they're free to do what they want. And I'm a finite person. Imagine how much more God... Is that God? Oh, no. That's Dick. It's close to God. God's agent. I want to love my kids, but I'm a finite person, but I love them nonetheless. Infinite God is full of love for me. If I don't call upon him, he doesn't come. He only goes where he's invited. So my wife and I, we invite him into our life. We have but one primary purpose: to carry the message to the alcoholic who still suffers. My wife is involved in Al-Anon in our community. I'm actively involved in AA. She doesn't ask me if I've called my sponsor recently. I try not to ask her if she's called her sponsor recently. She's a much more spiritual person than I am. But the fact remains that we have one purpose in our life, and that is to live together happily and usefully whole, not drinking. We've seen the destructive force of alcohol. There's a malevolent spirit out there that's trying to kill me. And there's a benevolent spirit that's seeking to save my life. And that spiritual warfare goes on a daily basis. An AA group will never endorse, finance, or lend the AA name to any related facility or outside enterprise, lest problems of money, property, and prestige divert us from our primary purpose. I don't know about anybody else, but somewhere along the line, I got the idea in my head that the person who dies with the most toys wins. That the early bird gets the worm, as if there weren't enough worms to go around for everybody. But there are. And so rather than try to achieve things and get things, we try to line our will up with God's will. And it's really kind of interesting to see what's God's will as opposed to Jack's will. And it's not easy to do. Clearly in our book, it indicates that I would much rather be the director. I would much rather write the script. I would much rather organize the play. But I neglect to remember that my wife has written her own script, which she prefers to mine. Our children have each written their script, which they prefer to mine. And so I can only suit up and show up and do the very best that I can to try and maintain this unity of purpose in our family and to not turn my focus and attention on acquiring more stuff or more toys, but just acquire whatever it is that God would have me do or God would have me be. Every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. You know, being self-supporting is a worthwhile endeavor. And if you're around Alcoholics Anonymous for any length of time, you hear a lot of people talk about the difficulty that they've had with money. Most of us have problems with money, and we have to be taught. I mean, I told Bob and Ken, I said, look, I'm making a lot of money. I don't have any problem with money. And Bob pointed out that any time you spend more money than you're making, you're having a problem with money. And I was definitely spending more money than I was making. And then he pointed out that I was using that money to buy stuff I didn't want or need to impress a bunch of people I didn't like. And I had no idea that that's what I was doing. So my wife and I have had to learn how to be self-supporting. And we have tried to impress that upon our children. And I'm happy to report to you here this afternoon that our three children are all self-supporting through their own contributions. And we're very happy about that. And we hope that they're happy too. Alcoholics Anonymous should remain forever non-professional. But our service centers may employ special workers. We do this to be of service to God and to our fellow man. We don't do this to make money. We do this because it works for us. We do this because our literature says, and my experience confirms, that I have to enlarge my spiritual life through work and self-sacrifice for others. But as an organization, there are certain things that have to be done for us. And we can seek out and hire people to work for us. Not to do 12-step work, but to do the stuff that keeps the lights on and the doors open. Now that may be in our local intergroup, that may be in our area organization, that may be in the general service office. But there are things that have to be done so that people who are on their way to us can find us. AA as such ought never be organized, but we may create service boards or committees directly responsible to those they serve. And that's what we do. We empower other people to act for us. We ask other people to be trusted servants. We ask people to work on our behalf. We have no opinion on outside issues, and the AA name ought never be drawn into public controversy. And I recall a number of years ago, I just come back from overseas, and there was a big article in USA and World Report. It was in September of 1997, and the article, the headline on the cover of the magazine was, AA Doesn't Work. And the story was all about rational recovery. And it was all about thinking your way into right living. And it was all about our critics and their criticism of us. And buried in the middle of the story, it said, Alcoholics Anonymous was asked to comment on this story, and their comment was that they had no comment. And I was attending a meeting of people who were treatment professionals. And there, as you know, there are treatment professionals who have never had a problem with alcohol who are credentialed as certified alcohol counselors. And then there are treatment professionals who have had or have alcoholism and have become certified alcohol counselors. The ones upon whom their livelihoods depended, the ones who had advanced degrees in the treatment of alcoholism, but no practical experience of any kind, rushed off to write letters to the editor of U.S. News and World Report to argue with and take issue with the contents of the report. Those who were certified alcohol counselors, who were members of Alcoholics Anonymous, said, oh well, and moved on. That's not easy to do when you worship at the altar of self-sufficiency and you're challenged. But if you are looking for direction from a loving and caring and gracious God, I don't like the tone of this article. I don't like the contents of this article. But I can accept this article. I don't have to approve it. It is what it is. Oh well. Our public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. We need always maintain personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, and films. At the level of press, radio, and films. We can't be anonymous from one another. Now, I say my name is Jack because if somebody is here is new and I say my full name, I don't want them to think that they got to do that. And also because this is being recorded and it may arrive in somebody's hands who's not one of us. And so I consider this to be at the level of press, radio, or films. But among each other, we cannot be anonymous from each other. I mean, have you ever had the experience of hearing that two-ton Tommy is in the hospital and you go up to patient information and say, I'm here to see two-ton Tommy. They don't list them in the hospital as two-ton Tommy. We got to know that it's really Tom Smith that we're there to see. We can't be anonymous from one another. But there's a good reason to maintain our anonymity at the level of press, radio, and film. And certainly in this day and age, you and I see it frequently. Because there seems to be a certain amount of social cachet of being standing before the paparazzi or some TV show, Inside Edition, or Access Hollywood. And just got back from a week at Betty Ford, month at Betty Ford, 6 weeks at Hazleton, feeling good, played golf, played tennis, not drinking, don't miss it. And then be found face down in your linguine 2 weeks later. What's that do for Alcoholics Anonymous? It gives an impression to other people that Alcoholics Anonymous doesn't work. So there's good reason to maintain our anonymity at the level of press, radio, and films. And another good reason is that anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all of our traditions. Ever reminding us to place principles before personalities. I don't know any place else where they teach this. I mean, I am judgmental. I mean, I can tell whether I like you or not long before I've met you. I don't even know anything about you, and I know I don't like you. And AA doesn't care. They really don't care. What I'm offered here is an opportunity to find out that God will use whatever vessel if I'll just listen. I don't have to make judgments about folks. And then I find out that I learn a great deal from a bunch of people that I really would not hold in very high opinion, relying on myself only. But I've come to understand here in Alcoholics Anonymous that it's the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous that keep us together. It's the spiritual principles. If practice is a way of life, remove the obsession to drink. And I think that's a good thing. But more importantly, it renders the sufferer, and that's me, I am the sufferer, it renders me happily and usefully whole. We have a lot of good literature that tells us about how our traditions evolved, hammer down on the anvils of pain. If you don't have a copy of The Language of the Heart, a grapevine publication, I would recommend it to you wholeheartedly. In there, Bill writes a great deal about our traditions and how they came to be in existence. And we have a pamphlet called AA Tradition, How It Developed, written by Bill. Article was written in the late 40s and early 50s, back when Alcoholics Anonymous was struggling, back when different groups had different rules for admission. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. We know that today. Our third tradition. We have one primary purpose, to carry the message to the alcoholic who still suffers. We know that today. They didn't know that in 1945. Alcoholics Anonymous was struggling because we had rules and we were afraid, and we had to learn and we had to be taught. And praise God, we did learn and we were taught. And so here we are on the 13th of November, 2009, 75 years from when Bill started his last debauch. Things are going to move quickly. Bill will sober up in December. He'll go to Akron in May. Dr. Bob will quit drinking on June the 10th. And 16 days later, on June 26th, Bill and Bob will go to the hospital to see Bill D., AA number 3. How long do I have to be here before I can start sponsoring people? Well, Dr. Bob was here 16 days. If you've been here more than 16 days, I hope you're sponsoring somebody. If you're not sponsoring somebody, you might want to sponsor somebody. I don't know if Pockets of Enthusiasm, that they have a countdown or not, but if they do have a countdown, and you see somebody who's got 10 days or 15 days or 20 days, ask them if they got a sponsor. If they say no, tell them you'll be their sponsor. They don't know they can say no, unless they're here this afternoon. Why not? What do you got to lose? Bob didn't call Bill. Bill went looking for Bob because Bill wanted to save Bill's ass. I come to Alcoholics Anonymous because I'm alcoholic. I have to concede to my innermost self what that means. I didn't sign up to be alcoholic. I just am alcoholic. And there's only one solution for me. In all of recorded history, there's only one solution for us. A vital spiritual experience as a direct result of taking action on these steps. Who knew that life could be so good? Thanks for letting me share.